We walked and got to the gig, and it was total chaos because I think probably the sound was... He was meant to go on at 7 or 8 or 7 o'clock at night, you know, as a solo man, just him and his guitar. And probably, I mean, all the people I knew, everyone was on acid inside the pyramid. I mean, they were having a whale of a time. But so the bands were running later and later and later. And once a band is on, you can't get them off unless you're very strict. You've got to be real tough and pull them off when the time is up. But nobody was doing that because they were all roaring and having a wild time. Not David, actually. I mean, he wanted to play. So the slots were going later and later, and they sort of wanted to send him home because there was nowhere to put him that night. He said, no, no.
Music festivals have become a rite of passage for young people. It's an opportunity to shed your 9-to-5 identity, to leave your doorstep with minimal possessions, and through whatever means necessary, commune with people who want to enjoy, for a brief period of time, freedom without consequences, joy without guilt, love with no boundaries, and not give a second thought to the morning after. It's a trail that was blazed by hippies long before Coachella and Burning Man. At the first Glastonbury in 1970, David Bowie brought his wife Angie, his friend Dana Gillespie, and his manager Tony DeFries to the rock and roll milestone and wasn't leaving until he put his mark on that stage.
They offered him then at 5 in the morning to play. That was the next free time. So, yeah, he did 5 o'clock in the morning. People had gone to crashed out in their tents, and I remember he was up on stage, and I just looked around and all these people crawling out of the mud, out of their tents, seeing this lone guy strumming away. The sun machine is going down, we're going to have a party, yeah, yeah. I mean, he's singing some songs that people didn't know his songs then, but it was just the boldness of having a solo act at this rock stage at 5 o'clock in the morning. And the sun did come up and peep over and come onto the pyramid. It was all pretty magical, actually.
David was a musical chameleon. He evolved from Space Cadet Major Tom to alien Ziggy Stardust to the self-destructive Thin White Duke. His looks transformed. His sound dissolved from one album into the next, and his fans bathed in the mind-expanding worlds he created. But before we get into the artistic fusion of David Bowie, we need to have a look at the arty teenager, David Jones, who was trying to find his way. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. David Robert Jones arrived on Earth January 8, 1947, in Brixton, London. His family was rather unconventional for that time. They didn't get married until David was 8 months old, and both parents had children from other marriages. His father worked in public relations for an orphanage, and his mother was a part-time movie theater usherette. David had a happy childhood, but his family was shrouded in tragedy. Several of David's relatives on his mother's side had suffered from schizophrenia, and a few had committed suicide. As a result, David felt isolated and removed from his schoolmates and dove into a world of fantasy. He enjoyed film, TV, and above all else, music. He mimicked the moves of Elvis Presley, the beats of Fats Domino, and the persona of Little Richard. At school, he experimented with his hair and his look. But it was a schoolyard scuffle with his best friend, George Underwood, that gave David his iconic look. A fight with his classmate over a girl ended with David suffering from a severe eye injury. After 3 surgeries, doctors were able to save his sight, but as a result, his pupil would become permanently dilated and look a completely different color. He was out of school for 3 months and felt even more distant from his peers. At 13, David began to learn to play the saxophone and the guitar. It was his older brother Terry who introduced David to the Beat Poets, Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road, and the jazz clubs in Soho, London. He had dreams of writing a musical for Broadway. He experimented with his image and developed his passion for clothes and fashion. The more outlandish, the better. David started performing in bands when he was 15 years old. His first band was the Comrades. He wanted to be seen as a musician, so he played it safe and stuck to the popular rock and roll sound of the time before embracing his imagination. Performing as Davy Jones, he became a mod and started the King Bees with George Underwood. The collaboration didn't last long, but David's dedication to music never wavered. His rebellious side started to come out with the formation of the Mannish Boys, and to stir up attention, he founded the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Long-Haired Men. Singer Dana Gillespie met him for the first time after watching them perform.
I had discovered the Marquee Club where blues was being played, and this was my joy, was to go from school quite often. I mean, I'd go home and change and nip down to the Marquee Club, and there was one night when he was on there, and I must tell you that I look much older than my years. I had waist-length peroxided blonde hair, and I was in tight black leather trousers, a quite wild-looking. I used to be a drummer in a band. I'd started very early. So I'm there, and I can't remember who the main act was, but the supporting act was Davy Jones, and I think they were called the Mannish Boys. So he came on stage dressed as sort of Robin Hood, straight out of Sherwood Forest, with almost shoulder-length yellow blonde hair in the sort of Veronica Lake style, bright lemon yellow hair, completely unusual. And he had this big white baggy shirt and a waistcoat and thigh-length suede boots with a kind of fringe on top, hence this Robin Hood look. You know, I remember listening to the band. I don't remember thinking, oh, this is great music. It didn't strike me one way or the other. But at the very end of the evening, they had mirrors at the back of the Marquee Club. And I'm standing, brushing my waist-length hair, thinking I'm going to have to walk home because I think the tubes had stopped at that time. And somebody comes up from behind me, takes the hairbrush out of my hand, carries on brushing my hair, leans forward and whispers, saying, can I come home with you tonight? And, of course, this was David. So I said yes. My parents had a very huge house, and my quarters were on the top floor, so David and I crept up. He spent the night there. And in the morning, first of all, I had to go to school, but I had to get him out of the house and past my parents' bedroom. And as we were coming down the stairs, my parents came out of their bedroom, and I introduced him because I'm well brought up. I said, you know, this is David. And he shook hands, and then I walked him down to the ground floor, and then he left. Then my father said, well, actually, I thought it was a girl coming down the stairs. From that point on, I wasn't looking to be a regular girlfriend. It wasn't that kind of relationship. It was very musical-based.
In 1965, he joined the band The Lower Third. They had a few released singles, but nothing that took off. David had another issue. His name was beginning to work against him. Davy Jones of the Monkees had gained pronounced fame, which was causing confusion. David looked to American history for a surname inspiration. He chose Bowie after James Bowie and the famous Bowie knife. David Bowie was born in September 1965. He spent a lot of time collaborating with Dana at this time and running around London looking for his next big inspiration.
I'd got a drum kit in my place and I'd got a recording machine, it sounds silly now, a thing called a Vortexian, a huge big recording thing which could double track, which was kind of pioneering in those days. We used to kind of go over songs together. He went out on his own with a guitar, because if you haven't got money for a band, you go out on your own. He was always very concerned about how he looked. In fact, in all the years, I don't think I ever saw him more than once slobbing about in a T-shirt and a pair of jeans. That was not his look. He had image already from the early days.
At 19, he released the single Do Anything You Say. The song had little success, but it attracted manager Ken Pitt, who began to represent him.
Both of us used to sit for hours in a famous cafe, which doesn't exist anymore, called the Gioconda in Denmark Street, Tin Pan Alley. And you'd sit in there and you'd nurse a cup of tea forever until somebody... Tin Pan Alley was where all the music publishers were, and they all had little studios underneath them. So maybe somebody's writing a song or just wants to record something, and they'd run into the cafe and go, has anyone got a bass player, or is anyone here a guitarist or a backing singer? And then you'd leap up and go, yes, yes. So one time I remember David rushed in and he said, come with me, come with me. He dragged me in around the corner to a shop which doesn't exist anymore because it all used to be only music stores in those days. Francis Day and Hunter was the music store. And he squeezed me into a little booth where you could go and listen to singles, and you had a sort of a foamy telephone which you'd listen to your whatever your music you wanted to buy. He put his first single on, which was I Pity the Fool and Take My Tip. I can't remember which was the A and the B side, but just that great feeling of your first single.
Ken's experience managing Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra made him a showbiz icon. He encouraged Bowie to get involved with burlesque and theater. He signed him with Durham Records in 1966 and released his first album.
David and I was signed to Decca, and I did two LPs for Decca, and David was also doing something for Decca, but a subsidiary of Decca. And although we were kind of moving, you could say, in tandem, he and I never really discussed what each of us were doing, because there were great long periods of time when maybe I wouldn't see him for, 4 months. He'd be off on the road. So it wasn't like we were in each other's pockets the whole time.
It was a whimsical pop album. Being a solo artist allowed Bowie to be experimental, and he was beginning to push the boundaries. He released a children's album next called The Laughing Gnome. At around the same time, his brother began exhibiting violent behavior, though medicine was monitoring his moods. As a result, he had to be hospitalized. It was a real blow to the musician, who was on the brink of great things. David was enjoying his musical success, but it wasn't enough to pay the bills. He took up Ken's advice and began acting to make ends meet. He was in an ice cream commercial and acted in some small roles. In 1967, David featured in the short film The Image as a drawing that comes to life. He realized he loved acting and began to study with Lindsay Kemp. Kemp introduced Bowie to mime and avant-garde theater. They collaborated on plays and toured around the UK. Their working relationship became more personal, and Kemp and David became lovers.
He said he'd met Lindsay Kemp, the mime guy. He said, yeah, I'm doing this show at a little theatre called the Mercury Theatre. This must have been maybe 1965, perhaps. He was learning from Lindsay all the kind of classic mime things that you learn about sort of being squashed or going along walls and things, but miming it Marcel Marceau style. So I went to see him. He was playing Columbine in a... It was a kind of fantasy thing. Actually, they always told me that Lindsay Kemp did all his shows on acid, but those days, I don't know, didn't notice any difference. But I'm sure he did, because he had a great time. And so I went to see David doing that. So he wasn't content to just be a singer. He did other things because he was interested to do everything.
The show had critical acclaim, but the dance troupe couldn't pay the bills either. While working with Kemp, he met and fell in love with Hermione Farthingale, a fellow actress. They started a mime troupe together and called it Feathers. David's manager, Ken Pitt, produced a short film called Love You Till Tuesday to promote David's singing and acting talents. During production, Hermione dumped David, saying the relationship was too intense, too fast. David was devastated and sunk himself into his art. But one day, after watching Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Oddity on acid, a spark was struck for David.
I was sitting around at my place in South Ken with quite a famous rock photographer called Gerard Mankovich and having a cup of tea, and then this call comes in, and hey, it's David here. I've just written a song and I've just finished it. I really think it's something special. I'm going to be around there in 10 minutes. Half an hour later, he's sitting playing Space Oddity to me. He said, what do you think? I must say, at the time, I wasn't thinking, oh, this is going to be iconic and marvellous. It was an unusual song, but nobody knew what the impact would be of this, of Space Oddity. But it was impactful because it was on that zeitgeist of people going to the moon anyway. And David was always very interested in space things, and aliens. And I remember, I think it was the first trip he went to America, and he called me and Angie back in London, and he said, I've just been to that... What's that place? Is it Roswell, where the aliens landed or whatever? He said, and I've met somebody, and there is an alien, and he's in ice. He's been put in ice, and it exists. But in those days, to get a telephone call back to England took forever, and it was crackly, and you could hardly hear anything. But so he always had an interest with what's going up there in the sky.
The week Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, Bowie's music was constantly being played. He finally had a hit. Space Oddity's success was short-lived. It was popular in the UK, but didn't ripple across the pond to America until 1972. Bowie was concerned that he had become a one-hit wonder. His newfound popularity made him a bona fide musician. He was getting recognized by fans in the streets, and David was embracing his newfound sex appeal. While performing at a gig, David met an American model named Angela Barnett. She was wild, outspoken, and outrageous. She was dazzled by David, and he was inspired by her.
He rang up one day. He said, you know, I've met this woman and I think you're going to get on well with her. So he brought her around to my place, which was by this time the basement flat underneath my parents' house, which Angie then christened the bunker. She and I instantly hit it off. She was sassy, funny, American. So that meant loud as well. If she walked into a room, heads really turned because she was built like a whippet. They both had the same waist length. They had the same measurements. I mean, they were identical. She'd go out and buy all his clothes because she only had to get them on herself in the shop and she'd take them home for him, even his shoes, everything. She did all of that. So I just thought she was great. She was very well educated. She went to a finishing school in Switzerland, came from a good family. And probably her downfall, if you can say it was a downfall, was landing up in the music, mad music business. But she was so dedicated to David and to push him, she recognized his talent instantly.
Angela and David were married on March 20th, 1970. Angela cultivated David and pushed him past his comfort zone into the fantasies he created. She encouraged him to play with his look and his sound. In May 1971, they had a son, and of course, they named him Zowie. He developed his first costume rock band, The Hype. The costumes and look were inspired by his wife, Angie. It was his first collaboration with lead guitarist Mick Ronson. This new look and rock and roll feel gave Bowie a new skin to explore. He was shy, and on stage, he never truly felt comfortable alone with a guitar. He always identified more as a performer than a musician, and this was the birth of something bigger than he realized. In order to move forward, he had to leave the past behind. He dropped Ken Pitt as his manager, but David knew to be able to move forward, he would need help. He met Tony DeFries, and Tony promised to make David a star, man.
The moment David met DeFries, he called me up and he said, I think I met the man that's going to be your manager too. So I went with David round to the offices were in Regent Street. And Tony DeFries did indeed change both our lives, probably David's more than mine. But by that time, there was enough money in the coffers, thanks to DeVries, to actually get a musician's in, which was the Spiders from Mars eventually. I mean, they were paid a pittance, but musicians in those days didn't expect to be having huge advances and, you know, weekly wages. This was unheard of. People didn't go into the music business thinking, I'm going to be a huge star and I'm going to make loads of money and be famous. You just went into the business to do your thing, to be a musician. And I don't think anybody could, I've been often asked, could you see David's fame and that he's going to be so huge? No, actually, because people didn't think in those terms.
Thank you for listening to A Life Lived. We'll be right back after this quick break. This episode of A Life Lived is brought to you by Skillshare. Skillshare is like the Netflix of learning, the open university for the 21st century. Indulge your inner David Bowie with a class on conceptual art. Or maybe find out if there's life on Mars with a beginner's guide to astronomy. Because you listen to A Life Lived, you can join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today and get 2 months for free by heading to skillshare.com/life. That's access to over 30,000 online classes for free at skillshare.com/life. What are you waiting for? Skillshare.com/life. This episode of A Life Lived is also brought to you by The Economist. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. For 170 years, it's been covering a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts, and so much more. Each week in its print edition, The Economist publishes obituaries on people who have lived remarkable lives. People like Charles Van Doren, the man involved in America's Great Quiz Show scandal of the 1950s. You know, the guy from Robert Redford's movie, Quiz Show? The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, get your free copy now by texting the word LIVED to 78070. That's LIVED to 78070. David Bowie was happy to defy expectation, and in 1971, Tony DeFries took David and his family to America. He was unknown in the States, but Tony could see the bigger picture. He wanted to sign him to a record label, so they performed a short promotional tour and eventually signed with RCA Records. David stuck around and absorbed the New York punk scene. He was introduced to Andy Warhol and his factory. The eccentric artist exposed him to Velvet Underground and became close friends with Lou Reed. So close that he would produce his solo album, Transformer. It was after Bowie watched A Rebel from Michigan that a famous friendship was forged. Bowie and Iggy Pop became comrades, collaborators, and confidants. Along with fashion designer Freddie Beretti and Lou Reed, the Merry Misfits would explore New York's underbelly. They watched experimental theater and films, hung out in gay nightclubs, took a lot of drugs, and brought the party back to Bowie's hotel.
I remember one day he wandered in with Lou Reed, and it sounds so silly now, but I remember this particularly because I'd never seen a man with black nail varnish, which was what Lou Reed had on. It's funny the kind of weird things you remember when you go back in the past, completely unimportant. But, you know, what was going on in New York hadn't really transferred to England. We didn't have the television links like you do now. So, yeah, he was kind of, I think he was getting geared up to do Walk on the Wild Side.
Bowie was a sponge soaking up all the incredible experiences in America, but he hadn't yet found the skin he was comfortable wearing on stage. In an interview with the trade magazine Melody Maker in 1972, Bowie proclaims to the world, "I'm gay." This was an extraordinary statement for anyone to make. People were becoming more experimental and flamboyant. It was a time of self-discovery and exploration. But to publicly declare your sexuality was dangerous and unheard of.
There was a man that created music that seemed to free up a lot of people who had been maybe a bit in the closet and could come leaping out and, you know, hey, I'm happy to be different. I'm happy to be gay or I'm happy to be whatever. He freed up people to take their lives a bit further.
When Bowie released Hunky Dory, you can see from the cover that he's in mid-metamorphosis. He narrated his transformation in the song Changes and told the world about his New York adventures in other songs like Andy Warhol. Bowie originally wrote the song for his friend Dana Gillespie.
To this day, I don't know why he wrote it for me. I often think that he probably thought of doing it himself, but I later heard that he tried to kind of get Andy himself interested, who was not interested in the song at all. I don't think Andy Warhol could get his head around what on earth Bowie was up to. So anyway, Bowie said, "I've written this song for you." And we did a funny demo with him strumming the old 12-string, Ronno on bass, and me singing. And on my version, on the final version, you can actually hear David's voice in the background singing, and it's him, of course, on the 12-string strumming away. And then he liked the version so much, he did his own version on, I think it's on the Hunky Dory album, I can't remember. So his album came out before mine because he couldn't actually produce my album as he'd promised to do because he was suddenly rising up in fame in America, so he took off for America.
Hunky Dory was a success. And Bowie was ready to enter into his next phase. He formed his band, The Spiders from Mars, while making Hunky Dory. And after 2 weeks, they began recording The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust. The Martian Misfits recorded the album at Abbey Road Studios. Bowie had everything laid out in his head. He would provide the bare bones of a song to lead guitarist Mick Ronson and expected him to understand it and refine it. He wanted precision and professionalism. He expected each track to be recorded in 3 takes or less. Everyone was on edge. The first single from the album, Starman, was released, and after Bowie performed it live on the popular show Top of the Pops, the album soared. Bowie struggled for a decade trying to secure legitimate success, and after one performance, he became a sensation. Bowie was no longer the struggling musician looking for recognition. He was Ziggy Stardust, the messianic Martian who traveled to Earth with the spiders from Mars. They told a story of the rise and fall of a rock god and introduced the world to a new era of glam rock. The show drew from Bowie's many influences and manifested in alien makeup and extravagant costumes.
One week he'd be very keen on kabuki theater from Japan. I remember watching kabuki stuff with him and, you know, this is where it's at. Then the next week he'd be a painter. The next week he might be heading for Buddhism. So he was always going for something else. The costumes that he wore on stage, I mean, nobody went out on stage with one leg naked bare and the other sort of that sort of little leotardy skin tight top. I mean, he always was skinny, although he had bigger hips. His hips were bigger than his shoulders, strangely enough. He sort of, one person said to me, slightly childbearing hips he had. Because, you know, normally you'd expect hips to be smaller, but he just was in these weird kind of clothes that nobody had seen before. But of course, a lot of it, Angie would say, this is great. Or they had a woman, several women, Natasha Korniloff was one of the clothes designers. And the other one was called Ann Proctor. And I mean, Angie, well, Natasha and David were anyway friends, but Ann Proctor did all these clothes and Angie would be out kind of saying yes, yes. The final say had to be David's, of course, but, you know, he had the option to see these weird things. And, I mean, no act was going out on stage looking like that. Nowhere. So he was completely original. I mean, not even in America were they doing this weirdness as what he was doing.
Their shows were a combination of kinetic energy and raw sexual presence. The chemistry between Mick and Bowie was magnanimous. They traveled the world on a wave of chaos, touring Europe, Asia, and America. Touring was arduous and took every last molecule of energy the band had. Yet while on the road, Bowie managed to write about the challenges of maintaining his persona and the vices he leaned on while touring. He poured his inner demons into the album Aladdin Sane, but it was really a call for help. He was trying to tell people he was becoming a lad, insane. This fame, this persona, this dream Bowie worked so hard for had grown bigger than he had imagined. And he was suffering. He was scary skinny, barely sleeping, and losing his mind. On July 3rd, 1973, Bowie and the band performed the last concert of the tour at London's Hammersmith Odeon Theatre. Bowie performed the show of a lifetime, and at the end, he announced to the world that Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars would never perform again. Everyone was shocked. Not even his band knew Bowie was going to announce this. After 1 year, Bowie killed his creation. Dana Gillespie knew about Bowie's decision before he took the stage.
I think he and DeFreeze both had the foresight that if you kill it off, it then carries on much longer. You know, if he was still doing Ziggy Stardust 5 years later, it would have been tired and old, maybe. So he got rid of Ziggy Stardust at the height. And I was with him and DeFreeze the night before when this was being discussed. It was a private, just the three of us meeting. Don't even think Angie was there. I don't know where she was. Probably worrying about his costumes or something. So I knew this was going to happen, but I wasn't actually there at the Hammersmith Odeon because I was stuck in Jesus Christ Superstar. But I mean, people didn't kind of, I think they thought they'd misheard it. They couldn't believe it, that this character was being killed off. But it gave him scope to go to other places. It was a very good business move in retrospect. And everyone had said, you know, how can he do this?
Bowie was ready to leave his alien alter ego behind and embrace a new chapter. He wanted to take the success of his creation with Ziggy and use them in an even bigger show with his new album, Diamond Dogs. The show would take Bowie's experiences with mime, his love of fashion, his fascination with kabuki theater, and the New York underground, and whirl them into a cyclone of creativity for the audience's viewing pleasure.
When we were in America, there was all these crazy, well, they weren't crazy, but they seemed crazy from the outside, people floating around. And I think David absorbed these characters very much into his lifestyle and into his songwriting. When I look back, when he was performing and he was being a character, he was magnificent. When I saw him in the Diamond Dogs show, which sadly never came to England, and I've got to say, I mean, I've seen many shows in my life. It's probably in the top three ever. But I mean, it was with great choreographer. There was this girl, Toni Basil. She was doing the choreography. She had a hit called Oh Mickey, some weird, weird hit. And they had a great team of musicians, and the lighting guy was the top New York lighting guy called Jules Fisher. There's all this stuff on stage. When he was a character, he was brilliant. But when he tried to be David Bowie, like Tin Machine, which he did later on, it didn't really happen. It was almost as if he wasn't that comfortable being himself at that time. He needed characters to be theatrical. He could get away with much more wild things when he was being a part or playing a part.
The show was extravagant, extraordinary, and expensive. Unbeknownst to him, all the money Bowie made from Ziggy Stardust was actually being paid back to the record label for the huge advances his manager Tony DeFries took. As a result, Bowie's own finances were funding the Diamond Dogs tour. Bowie was broke.
As he became more and more pressurized with the fame, it was quite difficult for him, especially the Diamond Dogs tour, which is always a shame that I think it was filmed by Yentob. Alan Yentob filmed it for the Cracked Actor BBC thing. But it should have been seen, actually. And, you know, he didn't like flying. He did, I think it was an 80-city tour in about 81 days. I mean, that's a hell of a schedule. Everyone else flew. He had this fear of flying. So he would go in this enormous big limo. And so sometimes his then assistant Coco, or sometimes I, would go with him just to sit and keep him company in the car. And although he was very, very tired, he never once did a bad performance. So they were quite special times, just sitting in the wheels, just going across America.
Bowie would have to make some drastic changes to survive. He pared down the show to make it more affordable. He removed the glamorous costumes, the mesmerizing dancers, and the mind-blowing sets. He reined in the glamorous lifestyle in swanky hotels and room service, and opted for more affordable settings. He moved his family to Switzerland to hide them from high taxes, and he fired Tony DeFries.
David wanted to split from the management. There was a big split. The House of Cards started to kind of fall to pieces. The reality is, when one wants to walk away, if the other one didn't really want it or wanted different terms, that's when the lawyers come in. So then there was litigation that went on for 3-4 years, and I couldn't record for anyone because I was stuck in the middle of the main man contract. So I had to go back to the Blasted Theatre, whereas David sort of ran for cover and went to Berlin and, you know, did his things there. But it was sad because for about 4 or 5 years, it was the ultimate happy family.
Bowie fell back on his music to cope with this huge disappointment. He looked for inspiration in the transition and used it in his work. He went to Philadelphia and steeped himself into the funk sound that pulsed in the streets. He collaborated with Luther Vandross and Ava Cherry to combine Philadelphia funk and Harlem soul with Bowie's spin. They developed a new sound and called it Plastic Soul. Fame, from the album Young Americans, is the first Bowie song to reach number one on the American charts. It was a collaboration between Bowie, John Lennon, and the guitarist Carlos Altomare. Bowie wrote the song about his tormented relationship with Tony DeFries.
This was when he was starting to listen to, let's say, James Brown, and there's several really good examples. I think it's the Fame track, and I don't know whether it's Golden Years. I can't remember because his later stuff I don't know so well. But there's an absolute copy of the James Brown rhythm guitar going on. So he took from, because he was starting to get involved with the black sound of music. Not the old blues, but the kind of the soul blues. That was kind of very interesting for him. So he was starting to put this into his sound as well.
The next album, Station to Station, was another hit for Bowie. Again, he created an alter ego to express himself. The Thin White Duke was a European living in America, getting swept up in celebrity, and before succumbing to the brink of self-destruction, he wanted to go home to Europe. Gaunt, pale, and bursting with ideas, this talent from another planet was the ideal person to play the alien in the 1976 film The Man Who Fell to Earth. Bowie's alien character lands on Earth in search of water to bring back to his drought-stricken planet. The film was not a blockbuster, but Bowie's performance received critical acclaim and showed the world the versatility of his talents. Between film shoots and recording studios, Bowie was leaning heavily on his vices. He knew he was in trouble, and he needed to do something before he would fulfill the destiny of his alter egos and self-destruct. He relocated to Berlin with his friend Iggy Pop. In a rented apartment above an auto parts store with no central heating, the two wanted to return to the basics. They hoped the city would provide a haven where they could get clean and shake off celebrity. Bowie produced Iggy's solo album Idiot during these years and continued to develop his own sound. He experimented with sound and substance in three albums he produced in Berlin, Low, Heroes, and Lodger. Bowie played with new technologies to distort sounds and melodies. He collaborated with artist Brian Eno and soaked up music from across Europe. He wrote the hit song Heroes in the shadow of the Berlin Wall without ever realizing how poignant it would be. Scary Monsters was Bowie's confession of his past sins and redemption to the world. In the single Ashes to Ashes, Bowie admits Major Tom is a junkie. The album was written almost as a cautionary tale. The same year, Bowie starred in the Broadway production of The Elephant Man. He performed the role without any effects or makeup and relied solely on movement to portray the twisted physique of John Merrick. People lined up around the block to see him, and critics praised his performance. 1980 was also a milestone for Bowie because his divorce from Angela would become finalized. Their relationship was shaky for years, and it was clear the two were heading down different paths. David fought for custody of his son and won. Bowie returned to London in 1982 and signed with EMI. He began production for his next album and recruited Nile Rodgers to help him create the sound. He wanted to make an album of hits that people could dance to. They retreated to Switzerland and made Let's Dance. It was Bowie's most successful album, with hits like China Girl and Modern Love playing endlessly on radio stations and MTV. Bowie traded in playing gigs for sold-out arenas. The music scene was evolving. Before, teenagers were limited in their music consumption to radio and records. Now, it was playing all day on their TVs, and Bowie noticed something that really bothered him. In a 1983 interview, Bowie called out MTV for not playing enough black artists. He was so heavily influenced by rhythm and blues, jazz, soul, and funk, and collaborated with so many incredible artists that he found their lack of representation disturbing and wanted to turn the mirror on MTV to self-reflect. In 1985, Bowie suffered a tragic loss. His brother Terry died. After years of struggling with his schizophrenia, he committed suicide. Bowie was always haunted by his brother's condition. He wrote about it later in the song Jump, They Say, which was released on his 1993 album, Black Tie, White Noise. He continued to act, and in 1986, he pulled up his leggings and got sinister with the role of Jareth the Goblin King for the film Labyrinth. He returned to his love of fables and nursery rhymes and collaborated with Jim Henson, Brian Froud, and George Lucas to create the topsy-turvy fantasy that would become a cult classic hit. In 1990, at a small dinner party, he met supermodel Iman and invited her out for tea. After 6 months together, over a candlelit dinner in Paris, he proposed. She described their romance as old-fashioned and refreshing. David and Iman married in April 1992, first in a civil ceremony and then at a lavish wedding in Florence, Italy. His 20-year-old son, who was called Joe, was his best man. Iman has said David fell in love with her instantly, but it took her about a week to catch up. David said his album Black Tie, White Noise was a wedding present to her. At the age of 53, David and Iman gave birth to Alexandria. He stayed very close with his son, who changed his name eventually to Duncan Jones. The 90s was not a groundbreaking era for Bowie. He released a few albums and he had a few hits, but nothing that equaled the popularity or recognition of his earlier career. Bowie was his youthful and vibrant self during the 2004 A Reality Tour. While on stage in Prague, his band noticed he started to act peculiar. During his performance at the Hurricane Festival in Germany, he had a heart attack. After the show, he was rushed to hospital and he had emergency surgery for a blocked artery. He never toured again. He continued to work with bands like Arcade Fire and even collaborated on an album of Tom Waits covers with actress Scarlett Johansson called Anywhere I Lay My Head. In 2011, after a 7-year absence, Bowie rallied the troops and headed back into the studio. The band members were handpicked. Each were told they were to work under a veil of complete silence. No one, under any circumstances, could talk about working with Bowie or what they were working on. Non-disclosure agreements were handed out to everyone on the first day. Recording sessions were short, which was very strange for Bowie. Wrapping at 6 p.m. instead of keeping everyone for a 15-hour workday was peculiar. His album Next Day was released in 2013. The cover of the album is a literal stamp on his iconic cover for the album Heroes. The rock album was a critical success. Bowie wanted to fulfill his dream of writing a musical for Broadway. Lazarus is about an alien trying to live in New York. The main character, Thomas Newton, is based on Bowie's character in the film The Man Who Fell to Earth. Michael C. Hall was cast in the lead role. While workshopping the show in New York, Bowie began treatments for liver cancer. The show was a tremendous success with sold-out performances. Bowie himself was able to see the show on Broadway and take one final bow with the cast. It wouldn't be Bowie's style to leave us without leaving a piece of himself behind. A message for us to contemplate. He recruited the Donnie McCaslin Jazz Group to help him score his final opus and his parting gift. Black Star was released on Bowie's 69th birthday. His message was clear. It's always been clear and consistent in all of his work. His message to the world is there is empathy beyond indifference. He said it himself. I don't know where I'm going from here, but I promise it won't be boring. The album itself won 5 Grammys. Bowie died on January 10th, 2016. In the words of the musical Marvel, the truth is, of course, is that there is no journey. We are arriving and departing all at the same time. Dana Gillespie didn't mourn the death of her friend, but celebrated his life.
All these people saying, this is dreadful, it's the end, I'm heartbroken. I view it as differently. I thought it was fantastic. This man was able to control his whole life, his career, and 3 days before his death, he brings out a new CD. Yes, good on you. He kept his illness secret. Fantastic. He controlled everything. After the DeVries thing, when he was finally in America, and by this time married to Iman, he was in control of what he was doing. And we've all got to die at some point. And it's every musician's dream is to do your final album. And that video where he's kind of going backwards and going into the cupboard, it's sort of like he's documenting his death. And God knows he had enough months to think about it. So maybe it was a bit of a shock for many people. But death is as important to us as something being born.
David Bowie was once asked by a journalist, how would you like your legacy to be written? And he said, I would love people to believe I really had great haircuts.
He's probably one of the most unusual that Britain has ever produced. There is no other one like him. But I never saw that when I knew him in the early days. He was unusual, yes, but there's no way I could have conceived how the people would react to him later on, when you see thousands of people with the Aladdin saying zigzag thing across the face, then you think, my gosh, you know, you wonder how it happened. But he managed to pull it off. He probably thought sometimes, how on earth did it happen as well? He did have a good sense of humour, so I hope he was laughing all the way to the bank.
Next time on A Life Lived.
She is just such a force. And so, you know, you walk down the street with her in New York and she stops and says hello to everyone and everyone stops and says hello to her. And she goes to the corner and buys the police officers on the corner a cup of coffee. And it's just an experience to be with her on the street, let alone, you know, spend time with her.
Documentary filmmaker Ricky Stern told us what it was like spending a year filming Joan Rivers, the brash blonde bombshell who broke barriers in the comedy world. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak, assistant produced by Paige Waller. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.